Funkadelics, Parliament. Look at you like that, do you?
Yes, sir.
So we start out with that, of course, because this is the day that man had his birthday, and we have to remember them on this day. Sun Ra and the Parliaments all in one day. We cannot go wrong. So
that's right.
That's it. Parliaments, give up the funk. So here we are. We're going to switch gears now, reminding you on our way to this conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association, from school funding to Common Core. You can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner. We are going to spend the next part of our program, before we meet a candidate for Attorney General, talking about national news events that have popped up. The Veterans Administration issues are a prime and in front of many people's minds. We're looking at the move with Venezuela that's taking place and what that says. I have a comment about that, maybe an editorial, and see what our guests think about that. We are going to look at many other issues, including the piece that came out that our producers found that the Chipotle's in Texas is telling folks they're not allowed to carry guns in their establishment. We'll talk a bit about that and the notion of toting guns and what that means as well. All that. And we are here with Zoe Carpenter, who is reporter for the nation's Washington, D.C. Bureau. Zoe, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Greg Klein is an attorney, co-founder, and contributing editor for Red Maryland, and hosts the conservative Refuge, right?
Yes.
Refuge. I almost said Refugee, but Refuge.
No, no.
Refuge podcast.
Not yet.
And co-hosts the Red Maryland Radio, and reminding everybody, Red Maryland doesn't mean communist, it means Republican.
That's right.
That's right.
Red state. Yes. We have a loose affiliation with red state.
How we got that terminology has shifted in America.
We've co-opted it. Yeah, absolutely.
Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University and a activist in this community. Good to have all three of you with us.
Hello, hello.
Yeah, good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, and we'll get your thoughts and feelings on the air. 410-319-8888. Let me begin with all the latest news. It was actually on the front pages of most of our national newspapers again this morning, which has to do with the crisis at the Veterans Administration, where certain numbers of veterans have said to have lost their lives because of the wait period. As long as I've been covering these issues here for the last 21 years, the Veterans Administration has always been, on some levels or another, a disaster. On other levels, does really good work, but on many levels, a real disaster for men and women who have served this country in the United States Armed Forces. And part of the issue here was really interesting to learn was that there was a report put out 10 years ago, before Barack Obama became president, when George Bush was president, that said that there is a problem with waiting times and that our veterans are suffering from it and we might lose lives. But no one seemed to act on the report. So just get our thoughts. Zoe, let me let you lead off, if you would.
Sure. So I think, as you say, it's important to remember that these sorts of issues have been around at the VA for a long time. And so this isn't just something that's happened under this administration. And there are some really good things that the administration has done in terms of cleaning up wait lists and helping to reduce homelessness among veterans. And I think that the major point here is that while it seems like there has certainly been bad actors that should be punished in terms of the creation of the fake wait lists, there's also a chronic resource shortages at the VA. And so we kind of have to ask whether it's reasonable to expect the VA to do what it's being asked to do when it's not funded properly.
I want to come to that point. I think that's an important point. I have some stats on that as well sitting in front of me. But go ahead, Greg, and then.
Well, it is true that this has been a problem at the VA for a long time. When General Chinesky became secretary 4 years ago, he mentioned this specifically as something he wanted to address. He wanted to get the wait times under 130 days. He hasn't made a lot of progress in doing that. And this is a big part of the problem that he's been dealing with for the last 4 years. This is continuing to go on. We'll talk about whether there's sufficient resources there. The budget has actually, from 2009 to 2015, is budgeted to go up pretty significantly. 68% is what I've seen. So there certainly are additional resources being put into the VA on this. But this is a perpetual problem that was known 4 years ago when General Chinesky came in and has really gotten worse in some ways. Certainly people now are dying, and we have this kind of you know, kind of almost perverted kind of system where we're giving over $2 million in bonuses last year to VA administrators who really had incentives to do what we're hearing happened in Phoenix and maybe other places, which was the, you know, to cook the books, to fix the numbers, something, you know, we in Baltimore have heard about such things before. And that's really the problem, why there needs to be some accountability in dealing with this, that has to be at a little bit higher level than what we've seen so far.
Well, Mark, you know I love history, so I'm going to give a historical perspective. One, I think people underestimate the extent to which policy takes place and is crafted within bureaucracies. So you can have presidents that come and go, but you have a lot of civil servants that serve for like 20, 30, 40 years. And so a lot of policies actually being made and driven by folks who are in the government. And I think we have to keep that in mind. So there's this cross party sort of element that often I think gets left out. The other thing, though, which I do think is historical, is that the Veterans Administration has had a long, you know, standing issues. You even go back to before the Army was integrated and the way that the VA did not give benefits to black veterans returning home from war. If we're pushing for restorative justice, and I believe we should, people should be punished, people should be fired for what is happening now. But I think the VA needs systemic transformation around the way that it conducts business. And I think even government-wide, we have this mentality that we want people to qualify for benefits. We don't think that people have earned benefits. And so these soldiers, they've gone to war, and now they have to have a doctor confirm and review the case and have all these procedures that are done to, you know, it took them a long time to confirm PTSD, took them a long time to confirm issues around Agent Orange related issues. And so we have this syndrome where we want to make sure that people have what they say they have. And I think at some point we've got to be more relaxed about that, because sure, there's going to be some waste and fraud. But I think especially with soldiers, wouldn't you trust and believe that if somebody say, look, I have this going on, doc, I lost my leg, I lost this, I lost that, give them the treatment first, and let's not wait so long to confirm that something is true before we go and say, now we're going to pay for it.
This is a really important point. And let's explore the last point that Lawrence just made here. I mean, there's all kinds of arguments to be made about the amount of money being spent on veterans and not being spent on veterans. But when we also talk about how do you create an administration that is, on the one hand, it's a federal administration, so it's governed federally, but is governed in a way so locally you don't have all this kind of red tape in the middle for veterans who face this stuff. And I've been addressing what you're talking about right now, Lawrence, is something I've seen occur since the 1960s with all the brothers coming back from Vietnam to all the people that have come back since. And so, and it's real. And and that they did not allow post-traumatic stress disorder in until very recently, when people actually accepted that something to be treated was going on with their vets, and how many people actually suffer from it, and how many different ways that the nuances of that disease affects people. So I'm curious how we think this has to happen. Yes. So there's levels here. A, rolling heads and accepting responsibility for what happened. But B, how do we reform? Zoe?
Well, I think the reform piece is really key, as we've been talking about. And for people who are concerned that that will lead to fraud or something like that, there are sort of simple things that we could do. Like, you could have random audits. So you could clear up some of that red tape, let people who have disability claims get faster access to care, and then you sort of retroactively look at those claims. And that would be one, I guess, compromise for people who would be worried about care. But I think in terms of reforming the red tape and helping people get access to care, that's not just at the VA, right? That's something that's in the medical system in general. And waits for care, racial and economic barriers to care, that's something that's throughout the whole healthcare system. And so this isn't just at the VA either.
Yeah, we're talking probably mostly, Greg Klein, you know, here about not just all veterans, but, you know, when you see that the number, what was the number that up perhaps 23 deaths nationwide were due to excessive weights, according to the one report that came out, which is absurd. And then obscene, 23 men and women who served died because they couldn't get into the hospital. So I'm, reforming, I think, is key. So I'm from a conservative perspective.
Well, I think obviously things need to be changed. You know, one of the problems from a conservative perspective is you've got a large bureaucracy. This is the way bureaucracies are. You know, having a government-run healthcare system is going to – one of the things endemic about it is that there's going to be delays. There's going to be decisions made about providing care that are based on how much it's going to cost.
Like the corporate system now, every time you try to have some procedure, they tell you, oh, no, you can't have this procedure.
Well, but you know, I think at least the corporate system, a real free market system, which we really don't have in this country anyway – it gives at least the user some options in seeking that kind of care. One of the things I've heard from the leaders of the American Legion is, at least in the short term, is maybe some of these people are waiting for care. Is there a way that we can allow them to just get private care outside of the VA system and have the VA pay for it? Of course, with private health care becoming more government run anyway, that may not be a suit. But that seems like the kind of outside of the box thinking, if we're talking about reform, rather than just changing the bureaucracy. And certainly, again, one of the things that's very disturbing is that there was this incentive system in place that these leaders of these VA were getting bonuses to have good numbers. And so the numbers became what's important. We see that in bureaucracies all the time. That, the incentive is to get good numbers and to cook the books, to teach to the test, or to, cook the stats, than it is to actually provide the care. And this is kind of endemic of that.
We have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back and jump right back into this and move on to Venezuela and some other issues that we're talking about here that I do want to get to as well. And a comment I'll just throw out, and we can wrestle this, is that in a true, let's say, single-payer system, private doctors would be able to get the money and treat people. It wouldn't just be public, and that might fill people up to really be private practitioners. Might not need all these bureaucratic systems. But anyway, on the way out, think about that as we go to break with Cosmic Slop, Parliament Funkadelic, because today is the birthday of Calvin Simon, born in 1942, who sang with the Parliaments and Parliament Funkadelic. We'll be right back. Thumpasaurus, people.
Gaga-guga.
Gaga-guga. Parliament Funkadelic. So we are here with Zoe Carpenter, reporter for the nation's Washington, D.C. Bureau, Greg Klein, attorney, co-founder, and contributing editor for Red Maryland, who hosts the Conservative Refuge podcast and co-hosts Red Maryland Radio, Dr. Lawrence Brown, community activist and assistant professor in the School of Public Health here at Morgan State University, 410-319-8888. Join us here by email at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, or you can tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So let's come back to where we left off here. And I'm just kind of thinking about, politicians, Republicans and Democrats in general, are not known for the kind of creative thinking about how to resolve issues. But but are very good at kind of partisan warfare, just chop heads. So I'm curious, it's your analysis of that and where you think this is going.
Can I say that, private companies have bureaucracies too. They're called HMOs. And so they work also to, verify claims and make sure that people have what they say they have. So even if we sent them to the private sector, we're still talking about the same behavior of reviewing before people get service. And so what I'm saying is, public or private, I don't care where they go. We need to have a mindset where it's, let's give people the treatment that they need. And if we need to do those random audits, let's do that. But let's stop assuming that people don't have what they say they have. Get them the service they need, and we'll figure out the rest later. Because I don't believe most of the people are lying.
And maybe, as Greg said, part of the solution is allowing people to go to their private health care.
Or outside of the system, at least to deal with the backlog.
So I'm sorry. I was directing to you, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, but outside the system, I think it's important to remember that it's not as if there aren't waiting lines and there there aren't barriers to care outside the system. There are lots of people who are waiting for care outside the system as well. And I think that, while it makes sense to loosen up some restrictions and to try to explore all possible avenues, I don't think we should pretend that that it's going to be easy to get the kind of care and get it affordably just because it's outside of the government.
True. So I'm curious where you think this is going to go in Washington, D.C., in that world you're covering.
You know, it seems unlikely at this point that there's going to be heads rolling at the very top. I think that that's reasonably seen as being an unproductive solution. That wouldn't really change anything. I expect we'll see inquiries and accountability at the lower levels where these kinds of decisions are actually made. But, you know, it remains to be seen whether the GOP will really try to make this an issue against the Democrats and make it try to make it a liability for them in the midterms and beyond. But, you know, the truth is that this is something that's not just tied to one administration, as we've already discussed today.
I am curious to see what this. What do you all think this is going to end up for?
There are definitely going to be investigations. It's definitely going to be something that the Republicans in Congress are going to look at very thoroughly and try to tie to the president. I mean, I don't think there's any question about that, fairly or unfairly. And there will be revealed bad things that were going on. We're starting to get that more and more. Whether that ultimately leads to better outcomes, I mean, we'll see. I'm not very optimistic either.
Right.
Now, I think the president should fire people. I mean, again, we're talking about either administrators that didn't make didn't help make things better, or bureaucrats who have been so entrenched for so long that they only can think in a certain way. And if we're going to have a new way of thinking, I think we need new people to come in and make that happen.
And I think it shows also the difficulty in turning these things around when you have these gigantic bureaucratic battleships, because you've got, I mean, Shinseki himself, a veteran who was wounded in Vietnam, who lost part of a foot, was part of the VA system himself. Now, he was never part of the VA system before this, but he was part of the military medical system after he was wounded. And so, I mean, it's not an easy ship to turn. So I think it takes a huge effort to make that happen. But clearly, more could have been done than was done. I think that and I will see where President Obama goes with this. I mean, he's made the statements that he clearly is on the edge, getting ready to fire Shinseki. I mean, that clearly seems to be where he was alluding to today. If things
He should go and do it if he's going to do it. I mean, letting it play out and then he gives into the pressure, I think, frankly, not that he wants my advice, but I think that would look worse for the president.
So 410-319-8888. Many veterans out there listening to the show, a lot of military folks, give me a holler. 410-319-8888. I'd like to see your thoughts on this. And, you know, let me ask this other question. This is something that, you know, we're watching the what's going on in Venezuela right now. We could look at what happened in Ukraine a few weeks back. And the folks, the Republican-led Senate, Republican leaders in the Senate want to
Lips to God's ears.
No, I take that back. the Republicans in the Senate are pushing a bill, for sanctions on Venezuela. And let me just throw the question out this way: it seems to me that we have gotten to a point where we start with years back when Hamas won the election on the West Bank in Palestine. Or whether the Ukrainians elected a government that was not really the liking of the United States, or whether it's a Venezuelan government who was, all the human rights election watchers saying it was a democratically held election, they won the election as Chavez won the election. And then if you look at America's history in the past with Mossadegh in the 1950s in Iran, or Arbenz in Guatemala, when it was just kind of blatant CIA, we're going to overthrow your government because we don't like you. But now it's much more subtle. And what are the consequences of a policy where the United States government kind of goes against democratically elected governments, or kind of went along with the Egyptian military when they overthrew Morsi, a democratically elected a government in Egypt? Whether you like Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood or not, it's not the question. So what is this a signal of?
Well, I don't know the Venezuela issue is the same. I mean, the concern is that there are violations of human rights as part of the government put down of the stuff. You know, the bill that's being proposed in the Senate, as I understand, is something that will give the president the ability to impose these sanctions, and the president will have the discretion on whether to do that. I think you know, I'm certainly someone of the realpolitik school of foreign policy that, you know, we have to do what's in America's security interest going forward. And if and that means, you know, supporting regimes that are supportive of us. I think one of the great concerns about the Arab Spring, for instance, was that it led to all these changes, but there was real question marks as to whether these changes were actually going to be good for America's long-term strategic interests or not, or whether they're going to make the region less stable and more likely to get into a situation where we're drawn into some broader war. I think that's one of the concerns that was held in Egypt. So, you know, I think the administration, whoever the president is, and American foreign policymakers have to have that as their North Star.
Zoe?
Yeah, I think the question we should be asking about these sanctions is what the objective is. And, you know, is our objective regime change, is our objective to get the Venezuelan government to change its tactics and to coordinate with to coordinate better and come to the table or to stay at the table because there are negotiations ongoing. And the second question is, will sanctions actually accomplish whatever our goals are? And I think there's real confusion about both of those points in this debate. I think there's little reason to think that any kind of sanctions, or at least the ones that are being proposed, will have a desired effect. They're unilateral. And so it's not something that's going to effectively isolate the Venezuelan government. And if you look at the history of sanctions on regimes that we're not particularly close with, Cuba being a good example, they have very little effect. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that they actually harden opposition to the U.S. and push the two countries further away from dialogue. Where sanctions have been really effective is in countries that see themselves as valuing their alliance with the U.S. So South Africa would be a good example. That's one of the reasons sanctions were effective there. And we don't have the same kind of influence and prominence in Venezuela.
I'm skeptical of America engaging in foreign policy as an empire as opposed to thinking about itself more as a national partner. The problem with only supporting the regimes that you support is blowback. Whether you look at some of the work done by Chalmers Johnson or Andrew Bracevich in his book Washington Rules, you know, the guns that you give to the Mujahideen or to the Taliban come back in the form of terrorism later on, oftentimes. And so I think that, you know, we have to be really careful with, you know, supporting these regimes that are both against our national interests and against their own people's interests. Oftentimes, I think diplomacy is underrated in today's day and age. We want to engage in cowboy diplomacy as opposed to real diplomacy. And I think we have to make sure that we are really talking to the people on the ground to figure out what's really going on and figure out what they want and not just impose our interests and overlay it onto what is going on in a particular country.
Well, if I can jump in.
Go ahead, Zoe, and then we'll go to Greg. Go ahead, Zoe.
Sorry, I think that point about diplomacy is really important. And if you look at the recent examples of Syria and Iran, we had breakthroughs there once we reached out diplomatically rather than in response to sanctions. So I think those would be good examples to look to.
And again, there are diplomatic endeavors going on. This is something that would, if this bill is passed, a potential sanction is something the president would have available to him. Whether it be effective or not, it depends. We use them in a number of places, and their efficacy is questionable. When we're talking about the Cold War and we're taking on the Soviet Empire, I think that's a different situation than we're in now. It's not as clear, there's not a clear line of demarcation. So I think I absolutely agree. We need to be careful, but that's true of, you know. That was true in the Arab Spring as it is now in what's going on in Venezuela. Are we backing someone who ultimately is going to be friend or foe? And I think there's a legitimate question about that in Venezuela.
I mean, I think also when you talk about human rights foreign policy, if there can be one, if there should be one, do we want to develop one? I mean, you know, we go after Venezuela where we allege that there's human rights violations, but you look at Bahrain, any other countries that we think we need our bases in, then they can torture hundreds and thousands of people and nobody bats an eye. Or the issue will not be raised. So I think that there are a lot of issues here, and I think that those kind of equity issues should be raised in a public platform for people to kind of wrestle with. I mean, there's this piece that we've seen lately in the papers about the CIA saying that they will no longer use vaccination campaigns as a way to spy on other countries and to get information. But other folks saying it's too little, too late now that there's now a polio epidemic rising again.
I mean by blowback, right? You have a strategy to go and spy on people, but you use public health as a way to do that.
And that's your area.
And that's my area. Well, what happens when people lose trust in public health? We know from the Tuskegee, the United States Public Health Service syphilis experiment in Tuskegee, and other many others that are detailed in Harriet Washington's book, Medical Apartheid, that when you engage in, you use public health in a bad way, in an unethical way, then you set up a situation where people don't trust, so they delay care, or they don't receive the shots. They don't go and get the service that they need to prevent the disease that's going to go and hurt and harm people, make budgets rise and inflate over time, and cause pain and death, depending on the particular disease. So the blowback is the thing that I don't think that America's been really smart about. These unintended consequences, we don't think through the way we intervene when we act globally, and it hurts and damages our cause.
Well, I don't know that no one thought about that. I mean, we were at war with the Taliban.
That's even worse if they thought about it.
but what I'm saying is we were at war with the Taliban. We're trying to track down Osama bin Laden. It was all, you know, we were pulling out literally all the stops, and this was, you know, bipartisan policy that was going on. And yes, I'm sure there was a recognition that if we do this, there's going to be a consequence. These kind of vaccination workers have always been kind of scrutinized in this part of the world in various countries. And now the Taliban is attacking them, and this is the consequences of that. So I'm not a big fan of the term unintended consequences. I think this was kind of a and it's legitimate to criticize it because it is taking it. You know, we were being sneaky and playing a trick on them and putting, you know, put the future folks doing this in harm's way. But we felt on a cost benefit analysis that is what we needed to do. And it's good that it's ended. But of course, the mission there is ended as well.
Let me read an email that just came in. I just want to switch gears here in a moment. And I just say, you know, when you talk about blowback, that when we look at what happened in Nigeria with Boko Haram and the kidnapping of these young girls, some people wrote this out that it was a CIA plot, which I kind of myself dismiss. I don't get into conspiracy theories too easily. However, when you get beneath those articles that said that, one of the things that was discovered was that people within the Boko Haram were funded by the United States government to take on both Libya and Algeria, pointedly Algeria, to take on the Algerian government to fund the undermining of certain governments. And the blowback is they now help develop this Boko Haram. I'm not saying the United States went and signed a letter saying, oh, we're going to support Boko Haram. I'm saying the efforts we did to undermine those governments through groups like Boko Haram led to the strengthening and development of Boko Haram.
And we refused to label them as a terrorist organization even a couple of years ago.
Because they were our friends at that moment. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We had an email come in from Deborah Fennell. This is about an earlier subject. When you read it, it's interesting. I don't know if anyone can answer this or not. Can someone on today's panel explain the process for appointing Veterans Administration's directors and removing them? There was a vote on the VA appropriations yesterday to make it easier to remove a director, manager. Can that be explained?
Well, again, civil service in America offers you a lot of protection. So they have unions protection. They have, have to go through panels and hearings and make sure somebody's not being fired inappropriately. But, you know, I think it's a fantastic question because in the case where there's gross violations and people are dying, you know, I think, you know, everybody, you know, ought to back up and say, you know, this is something that we don't want to allow.
So, do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, you know, it's not quite my area of expertise, but I think that what was just said is basically what I would consider correct about the protections that are in civil service are important. But in this case, you know, they can get in the way of quickly addressing things too.
Yeah, Congress was passing a bill that would lower that threshold, so obviously it was higher.
Right. But, you know, I think we'll be following this, and we'll be bringing some veterans on shortly to kind of talk about this as well and their own experiences with the VA and hearing what they have to say. We've done a lot of programs on PTSD and other things that veterans have faced, whether they were veterans who served in Afghanistan, Iraq, or the people who fought in Vietnam, and more to talk about this and where they are. And there's a lot of active groups like that in this community that we'll be talking to, and people who started Vietnam Veterans Against the War back in the early 70s, and hearing what they had to say about what that situation is. We're hearing those voices. 410-319-8888 is our number here. This is not at the top of the news. It's not in Washington, D.C., but I found it very interesting, too, that you know, Texas has the your right to carry law. And Chipotle said that we don't want you carrying your guns. Please do not carry your weapon, bring your weapons inside. And I find this is an interesting kind of, I think, huge both political and cultural divide in America over this notion of carrying guns. And I'll say, as I said before on this program, I mean, I don't have any desire to carry a gun. I am a gun owner, and I put that on the table. So I'm putting it out there that I'm speaking from that perspective as well. But the idea of our need to want to have to carry guns in public, to show the weapons on our hips, to have them bulging from out of our gut, and Chipotle saying, no, don't bring them in my house. What are our thoughts on this?
Well, look, I think a private business should be able to have some say in that and who they invite in and under those conditions. You know, we live in a state where we can't wear a gun on our hip unless we go through an extremely difficult and lengthy process. Okay. And even then, unless we know head of the state police, it's probably not going to happen. So I can understand most of the people listening to this having no concept of a state like Texas where they have a shall issue permit for concealed weapons and you know, they have a culture where they're not afraid of guns, where guns are tools that are used commonly. And so I can imagine, especially going into a Chipotle, I imagine there's some culture shock going on there. So I can certainly understand that. And it is not just a political divide. It is a cultural divide in our country. Because if you talk to people who believe very strongly in the right to bear arms, they have a very different worldview and often a very different life experience than the folks who are the most ardent about gun control.
Yeah, remember that the one of the biggest reasons that people don't have the right to carry, let's say, starting in California, was because Ronald Reagan decided to make it illegal because black folks Panthers. Were carrying guns.
No, specifically the Black Panthers.
the Black Panthers.
Who were carrying open rifles out Sacramento.
Any thoughts on this, Zoe?
Sure. Well, I think it is a political and cultural issue, but we also have to remember that it's a public health issue, and the NRA has been pretty successful at shutting down that conversation, certainly in Washington, about the public health implications of loosening gun laws across the country. And so I think it's this Chipotle incident, if we can call it that, is interesting to sort of pick at where the gun rights and gun control movement is right now. You know, from one perspective, it's kind of amazing that the group Moms Demand Action has been able to work with some private companies to start, you know, raising this dialogue about open carry laws. From another perspective, it's a little bit sobering to think that after the Sandy Hook shootings, that's where we're at. Nothing has been happening in Washington, and at the state level, in fact, gun laws have been loosening rather than becoming more strict. So, you know, I think it's a really telling example that that's where the action right now is focused, is on private companies and on individual actors rather than legislation.
Yeah, it was Moms Demand, as you were just saying, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America tweeted. The people were a picture of two guys carrying guns inside of a Chipotle restaurant, and that began this campaign. And then they asked customers to tell Chipotle that such images aren't acceptable, and we won't feed our kids next to armed gunmen. And then within 24 hours, Chipotle said, "We don't want guns." That's how that kind of unfolded.
Two guys ruined
it
for everybody.
Similar campaigns.
Pardon, Zoe?
I was going to say they've had similar campaigns related to Starbucks and Staples, I believe. So this is something that they're actively working on now.
Right. We need to follow this and see where this is, and we'll enter that debate in some.
It's interesting that we're infusing culture and politics into corporations, and you know, and a lot of those corporations have cultures of their own. It'll be interesting to see. I'm not a big fan of that trend.
Which trend?
I'm not going to go to this place, or this place is more identified politically or culturally with one side.
But it does make
problematic.
Sense. It does make sense from a standpoint of, as our friend Mitt Romney said, that corporations are people, my friend. So,
well,
I mean,
and they can make those decisions, and the marketplace can decide.
Yeah, as they engage in more personhood.
There'll be some taco place in Texas that says, bring your guns in, we'll give you a free taco.
Exactly.
So
I think you'll start to see more of this, actually, more corporate affiliation shading Republicans, shading Democrat, and then people making market decisions about whether or not they're going to frequent those establishments based on that.
We may. That seems to be where it's going.
So I'm going to care. We only have a couple minutes left yet. I meant to bring this up much earlier, but we'll do this later. And let me ask Zoe just a comment very quickly what you're seeing in Washington around the death penalty issues from the Supreme Court and Alito staying this execution and Obama kind of ordering a review of executions. What is the politics that we're not seeing?
Well, I think that this is a real watershed moment. The Supreme Court has been asked to stay previous executions this year, and they declined to do so. But every decision, you saw a new justice join the side of those who wanted to stay the execution until yesterday, when we had a majority who voted to stay that execution. And I think that the politics behind this may take on a more ugly partisan tone. I think they already have, of course, the states that are pro-execution and gung-ho about these secrecy laws are red states, and there are conservative politicians who are backing these laws. So I think that will be something to watch for, how much this splits along party lines. If you're a conservative, you should be concerned about the amount of resources that we are putting towards executing people, because it's tremendously expensive to do that. It's more expensive than putting people in prison for life, and it obviously raises a lot of constitutional questions as well.
Well, I want to say I wish we had more time, and I should have brought this one particular very important issue up earlier, but we'll come back to this. And I want to thank all of our guests for being here. Zoe Carpenter, it's always great to have you on the show with the Nation Magazine's D.C. Bureau. Thank you so much once again for joining us. Enjoying your writing a great
Thanks
deal.
Thanks for having me.
Greg Kleins, always good to have you in the studio here.
Appreciate it.
Co-founder and contributing editor for Red Maryland and host of Conservative Refuge podcast and does a very good job. And Dr. Lawrence Brown, community activist and assistant professor of public health here at Morgan State University.
Ka-ka-ka-ka.
Funkadelic talk. And on our way to our next conversation with State Senator Brian Frosch, who's running to become the next Attorney General of the State of Maryland, I will remind you to join me tonight at Red Emmis at 7:30 for a conversation I'm hosting with Eddie Conway, former political prisoner and Black Panther. He'll discuss his work with Baltimore youth, both inside and outside the prison, his life in prison, how he saw things change, where he sees the future going. It's also a fundraiser for him. I'll be signing in his books as well. That's at Red Emmis tonight at 7:30 at 30 West North Avenue. We'll be taping it so we can air this conversation for you on this program as well. More information available at redemmis.org. We'll be right back with State Senator Brian Frosch.
Your sexy body. Baby, let me see you moving on the